So first thing, can you tell us your name, your position at the court, and a brief summary of what you were doing there?
So my name is Vincent de Wilde d'Estemal. So I'm Belgian. And I worked for the court as a senior assistant prosecutor, which is the title for one of the prosecutors there. And the second question, you?
Just a quick summary of what your duties were at the court.
So the duties of a prosecutor are multiple, because we intervene at each stage of the proceedings. So at the preliminary investigation stage, we mostly gather evidence, analyze it, and determine what crime sites or suspects should be investigated further or prosecuted. During the investigating phase, which is carried out by the co-investigating judges, we just monitor and file some investigative requests, if possible. So we follow up, we analyze further, of course, as the defense does. And during the trial phase, we have, of course, oral submissions. And all through the proceedings, we have written submissions, which take a long time because we make requests, we respond to requests and submissions by the defense, and that's a lot of time, research, legal research, factual research.
What brought you to the ECCC in that role?
I was first in Brussels. I was part of the Bar Brussels Association as a defense lawyer at the beginning of my career. And then I worked 11 years in Africa, including 6 in Rwanda just after the genocide from 1995 to 2001. I also worked in Cameroon in the prisons. It's a justice development project to establish a legal aid system to defend long-term pretrial detainees. And then I worked in Côte d'Ivoire for 2 years during the war with a peacekeeping mission, and I was a deputy head of the rule of law section there. So we would also monitor, we would evaluate this judicial system in Ivory Coast, but also monitor some of the trials conducted against rebels during the war. Then when I was there, it was a non-family duty station. So when I applied here, there were two goals. First, I really wanted to be part of this this justice being rendered for Cambodians so long after the time of the Khmer Rouge, but also on a personal level, I also wanted to be in a family duty station so that I would reunite my family, because I was separated from them for some time. I think what the Office of the Co-Prosecutors was looking for at the time was someone with a civil law background who spoke French and therefore knew a little more the specificities of the court here, which is inspired by French law.
Yeah, absolutely. Tell us a little bit more about what you did as a prosecutor at the ECCC. What was your day-to-day work like?
Well, as I said before, we started with analyzing evidence because we have to prove cases. We had to make some choices at the beginning to select crime sites and suspects and set of crimes that would be representative of what happened during the Khmer Rouge era. So at first, also with the help of DCCAM, we had a lot of evidence, access to a lot of evidence. We had to analyze, check the names, check the credibility of some witnesses, interview some witnesses. So that was the beginning. Determining which priorities we had in those cases during the first year, and then once we had determined which crime sites we wanted to be investigated and what type of suspects we wanted to have prosecuted and tried, then I was responsible for some of those suspects. That means heading a little team of investigators, lawyers, and interns to make the research and compile this research in a document like introductory submission, but later on monitoring the investigations that were carried out and then write sections of a final submission, which is the document we produce to summarize the evidence at the end of the investigation, for example. So it's a lot of entering data in databases, but also, you know, reading, cross-checking documents, assessing the authenticity, the reliability of documents and witnesses. And then we try to put all this together in the most objective way to make sense.
Okay, can you tell us a little bit more about any challenges you might have had at the court?
Okay, they are more or less the same than the court faced. First, at the office and in the court, we have the challenges of the language. So we have three working languages. I'm the only French speaker in the office. So I'm grateful there are three languages, but actually it complicates things. We have, I think in total at the court, about 60% of the documents that are in Khmer originally, 30% in English, maybe a bit more now because of the proceedings, and 10% of French. So the translation issue and of course the interpretation within the courtroom has always been a big challenge and something that's probably extended the time necessary for this court to achieve results. That's one of the challenges. Another one, which also makes the beauty of this profession, is the cooperation with national counterparts. We've always worked together. Of course, there's some language barrier and cultural differences we had to overcome, but that went quite well, I must say. As for other challenges, of course, the size of the case, the magnitude of those cases. We spoke about case 2/2 as the biggest trial ever since Nuremberg, and I think this is correct. It's so massive, so many people were involved, so many people died during the Khmer Rouge era, nearly 2 million in less than 4 years, and it was nationwide. So it is very challenging to analyze the evidence. And also because the Khmer Rouge were using revolutionary names, for example, it makes it a bit harder to understand who did what at what time, because also they changed their names over time. The spelling might change. So for a foreigner, that's the things that are a bit difficult for producing a high quality analysis of the evidence. But I think we globally achieved that well.
I'd like to talk about the hybrid aspect of the court. What do you think the positive and negatives of having this kind of court were?
So the first positive aspect of this court, and not necessarily because it's hybrid, but it's linked to it, is the fact that this court has functioned in Cambodia and not outside. I've been working in Rwanda 6 years, but in the national justice system and not at ICTR. ICTR was seen from a Rwandan perspective, and the victims in particular, as being very, very remote, very far from people. There was no sense of ownership. People knew more or less what was happening, but it was in Tanzania, far away from Rwanda. And so there was no proximity. They could not see justice being done. And here, that's the main difference. Probably the most positive aspect here is that many people attended the hearing, many people visited the court, many people saw what was happening and knew they could attend if they wanted. That's absolutely positive. Another positive aspect is the cooperation with the national counterpart, of course, and the capacity building as well. I think globally it worked well, despite the fact that our national counterparts accumulate also a national position for the most part inside the national justice system. But whenever we had to cooperate, and we did that well in cases one and two, I think it was quite interesting to exchange and to produce a good quality result. Also for them, it was new to have such cases of massive importance, number of evidence so high that they, like anyone else in a national justice system, you never see such things. So bringing that experience, not necessarily me, because I did not work in a former tribunal, other international tribunals before, but colleagues who did, were there also to bring that experience and explain how we would handle this massive amount of evidence. Now, if I take another aspect is of course the proximity to the victims, I would say, and the fact that we were in Cambodia made it easier for the civil parties and complainants to come forward and participate in the proceedings, even if it's not always in the most active way through their lawyers. But they had the opportunity to attend the hearings, they had the opportunity to present their testimony in court, and in the case of Rwanda, for example, the victims were limited to be witnesses. And that's not, I think, the exact role a victim should have only. Now, the negative side, you said, of the hybrid court is it's quite unusual to have in each department two heads, so two prosecutors, two investigating judges, and then at the judge level, a majority of Cambodians and a minority of internationals, but who have the possibility to block a decision. So it is a complicated system to handle. And there is a system in case of disagreement. When there's agreement on everything, there's no problem, of course. It works perfectly fine. When there's a disagreement, I think the procedure is a little bit heavy. And it looks like the internal rules did not anticipate all situations. So that can lead to some difficulties in interpreting the various situations, as it is now, for example, where we have two different orders from the two investigating judges, for example, on some cases, contradicting orders. So what do we do with that? It's not exactly a scenario that is envisaged by the rules explicitly, even though we have an interpretation of that. So it is a challenge. At the same time, it's not impossible to handle, but it complicates a little bit the proceedings.
So talking a little more about the different positions that sometimes occurred between the national and the international teams, can you talk a little bit more about how both sides were able to work together, or perhaps how they worked through some of their disagreements?
Well, you know, for years we had absolutely no disagreement on case one, case two one, case two two. We worked hand in hand. I think it went quite smoothly. You could see that in courts. I mean, we shared the time. We also share, actually, offices. In my office I have my national counterpart, and many of my colleagues' offices the same. So everything is made so that we work together. Now, for the cases where there has been a disagreement, a difference of perspective, things have always been clear since the start, and so there's no ambiguity. We continue to work together as normal. There's no tension at all. It's just that we have different views. We express different views before before the judges or the court, and then it's to the judges to decide. But it does not really cause any sort of problem on a daily basis. It's just different point of view.
Sure. So you mentioned that you have worked for the courts in Rwanda and a number of other areas of conflict. Can you talk to us about how your experiences at the ECCC differed from those other experiences or perhaps other courts that you've worked with?
Well, so in Rwanda, I didn't work for ICTR, as I said, but for the national justice system, and the perspective were quite different. Because there, there was a will to prosecute and to try all participants to the genocide of the Tutsi and other war crimes and crimes against humanity. So the perspective was, of course, quite different. We had there smaller cases individually to investigate, because the big leaders were tried by ICTR outside the country. It really changes perspective. Instead of having a little number but with lots of evidence, we had a very high number with probably less evidence for each of those persons suspected. So the perspective is completely different. In Belgium, I worked on criminal cases as well, but these are classic cases, not involving international crimes. So even when a case is big, it's never as big as I don't know, hundreds of one of those cases we have here. So it's really the magnitude of the crimes, the number of victims, the types of the crimes themselves. When you have crimes against humanity, genocide, war crimes, we speak about crimes that really touch, as the name indicates, everyone in the world. It's like it's really affecting the human beings, but not only the victims there, but it's a negation of what a human being is. So, yes, there's another dimension to that. And it is challenging, but it's also very interesting to see how the people we have tried so far reacted when they were confronted to those crimes. We have different reactions, of course, with Dutch cooperating and then Nunchi Akyusampan continuing to deny, which is, of course, a blow, I think, for the victims, but it's the reality.
Absolutely. So thinking about your time at the ECCC so far, are there any lessons learned or best practices or recommendations that you'd have for future tribunals that stand out?
Well, I think when we started at the beginning, nobody really believed we would have gone so far, particularly case one, case two, which is a very, very large case. And we've got the judgment, 2,400 pages, I think, approximately. So I think the first lesson is you need to trust justice. Justice can be rendered, even if there's challenges that look impossible to overcome. Yes, it is possible to achieve good results. Now, if it had been possible to hold those trials much earlier, it would have been much better as well. 30 years, 35 years after the facts, it is too late. It's, of course, better than nothing at all. Much better, actually, for the victims. Even if it comes late, it is still very important. But for the evidence, particularly the testimonial evidence, it's more difficult for people to remember. So relying on, for example, the chronology or the dates, you know, that witnesses can provide is a bit more difficult in that scenario. So the role of the civil parties in those trials I think that's also something positive that could be replicated, if possible, in other courts. If it was not for the role of the civil parties, I don't think I would have been part of this system. As I said, in Rwanda, ex-Yugoslavia, and elsewhere, in Sierra Leone, people who were victims were not allowed to play a major role. They were just witnesses like anyone else, and then submitted to a questioning, cross-examination by the defense, and always seen as people who would provide just evidence, but not considered as victims with their sufferings. And here the difference is that victims could also express their sufferings in public. And that made a big difference because it brings more humanity to those proceedings. And I think that's important, and unfortunately that's not something that you see in many other courts. So I would also favor courts with only two languages, one, of course, here. Two would have been ideal, and I'm not saying this for myself, because if it was not for French, probably I would not be here, but you need to select two languages instead of three. It would speed up the process a little bit. Another lesson learned, I think for a court of this size, it would be much better to be under the UN budget than depending on voluntary contributions of the states. You know that politicians have a different agenda and time of than justice. Justice takes a little too long for politicians always. That's what they see. They have like four years term, 5 years. They don't see justice, you know, justice that is delivered with all the guarantees for the defense rights and so on, takes a little time. And so the donors were enthusiastic at the beginning, but then when it takes long, the enthusiasm starts to erode a little bit, and that's a problem because we depend on them. And so we had some budgetary problems at some point, and I think this should be avoided. It's not really compatible with international justice. So we should, of course, make everything possible to speed up the process, but at the same time, we should have the guarantee that some budget adequate funding is there. Also, the fact that we had just one courtroom, one panel of judges for the trial chamber made it impossible to have two trials running at the same time. And then people or donors believed maybe they would save money by doing this, but at the end it may last longer than it would have been if we had more means on a more concentrated period than just less means, but then it would stretch for maybe longer. I would also probably recruit more lawyers from civil law systems. The fact is that in other international courts, many lawyers come from common law system, and also they are more inspired by common law. Here, it is a system within Cambodia which is derived from French law. So definitely having more civil law lawyers would have helped not falling into some of the pits we had here, where some people say we combined the worst part of both systems, which I think it's an exaggeration, but at the same time, we would not have those hearings where the judges play a too passive role and then they require the defense or the prosecution to stand up and object to questions from the other side. That's very much common law. We don't see that much in civil law systems where the judges play a more active role and direct more the debates. I think we would have gained some time with a little more civil law perspective than common law. And I think that's all for the best practices and so on. Yeah.
Thank you. Is there any opportunity or task that you think should have been done by the courts but couldn't be for legal reasons or any other issues?
Well, you know, when the negotiations were held, nobody really knew how many people we would try. We've chosen to select a number of people on the international side of the prosecution that would be reasonable and representative of the leaders and most responsible people, most responsible for the crimes committed. But maybe we would have chosen a bit more people if we knew that there was more means at the disposal of the court and so on. But still, there's some things maybe that could have been done or better. Something we did not see immediately was the importance of the forced marriage, for example. At the beginning, we were not really much aware of this. And when we realized through interviews, the witness interviews and so on, that it was actually something that happened at a very large scale, we tried to correct this and address that by issuing supplementary submissions and in all cases. But that's something we had not seen immediately. And therefore, also at the investigating judge's office, they did not have specialist female trained investigators to specifically address this issue. So they came, but they came a bit late, for example. So that's something I would do differently if we had known the magnitude of those forced marriage, for example. Yeah, I think, I'm not sure I know. I have other things in mind at the moment, so.
Okay, great. Well, thinking a bit more at your time at the ACCC, what challenges do you think future courts will face when dealing with mass atrocities like this?
Well, challenges are globally the same, is to manage to use tools that allow them to analyze, gather evidence, link the evidence together, and understand really what happened. And of course, the historical truth is a bit different from the justice truth, which is, I mean, the threshold is high. We need to prove beyond reasonable doubt. So the challenges are more or less the same, but probably if the court starts much earlier than here, they will be able to rely even more on testimonial evidence. Here we had the chance to that some of the archives found in S21 or in some other places in Phnom Penh and also Klang Tai Chan survived. So we had the basis to start the investigation. So we would rely on testimonial evidence, but with that basis of contemporaneous documents. In some other areas, maybe the situation might be quite different and they have to rely more on testimonial evidence. If the crimes were committed just before, a few years before, I think it can be easier. The challenges of the funding, languages to handle, having a hybrid or non-hybrid court, I mean, this must be addressed at the start. But clarifying rules is very important, of course, for interpretation later.
Are there any experiences you had at the ECCC that changed your perspectives on anything?
Changed? Well, when I arrived, I didn't know we could have achieved so much, actually. It was, we were trying to carry on our activities month after month. We had no real guarantee we would go forward with some of the cases, or that, of course, the accused would survive. And we've seen some of them died during the course of the trials or after the trial was the trial judgment was rendered. So personally, I didn't know I would stay so long, of course. So yes, my perspective changed in that sense. But of course, I think the knowledge we acquired is now very much more significant than at the beginning. So the analysis we can make now, I think, is more accurate, and it goes. I think the results are quite interesting, because before we had the work of historians, of course we had E.C. Cam, who had done a lot, but with those documents we gathered and we analyzed, and all the additional testimonial evidence made in court or before the investigating judge, there was additional evidence coming in all the time, and I think now the knowledge and the acquired and that you can see in the judgments that were passed is really interesting. I think it goes way beyond what historians had put together before. So that's all I can say, I think.
Thank you. We definitely appreciate having the perspective of someone who was at the court for a full 12 years, which is a bit longer than some of our other guests so far. So keeping in the boundaries of what has been released to the public, are there any accused or survivor stories over the course of your time at the ECCC that really resonated with you that you could tell us about?
On the victim side, there's a few. Of course, personally, I interviewed lots of victims in court, but Sue Sotivi testimony, she's a transsexual, and she was not only forced to evacuate the city of Phnom Penh, but also forced to marry as a man. So really denying her identity as a woman. That was very emotional moments, like any victim or any person who came to testify. Particularly, I would say, Cambodian people who are not very much educated and had to testify. And it was challenging for them, and they're very impressive in this cold room. They were very stressed sometimes, very impressed by the decorum and the judges and all the parties there, and facing all of them, and suddenly they had to express themselves and express their sufferings or their feelings. And it was so, you could see it was so hard for them to say something, put words on their sufferings, but you would see in their eyes that what they were saying with their words was not sufficient to express all what they had lived, and it was so touching. Of course, then you had victims who could express better and put better words on their sufferings, and it was very interesting too. But to have people who never had to express themselves in public and do so many years after the facts and still bursting in tears because it's one of the first times sometimes they get to explain things. I think it really played a cathartic role also for the other victims outside the court. And it was important. For the other witnesses, one that impressed me was Salot Ban. Salot Ban is the nephew of Salot Sar, Pol Pot. Then, and I interrogated him in court. And sometimes it's turning to the judge or reading a question and then looking at him. And his resemblance with Pol Pot was so troubling, I mean, disturbing, that I was like shocked sometimes when I looked at him like, oh, like Pol Pot is in the courtroom. He was his nephew, but he was so alike, same type of expression, same type of gentle smile, and so on. That's a memorable sight. And then, of course, there's on the accused side, Duch. Duch, although his own trial didn't end well, because at the end, he requested to be acquitted, which was quite incompatible with the cooperation he had. And of course, the victims were very disappointed, the civil parties, when he expressed the fact that he would like to be acquitted. But despite all of this, he cooperated in the other cases. So his cooperation in case two, including in case 2-1 hearings and case 2-2 hearings, after so many years, he could have said, it's enough, I cooperated with the court, and at the end of the day, I've got a life sentence, so imprisonment. I'm not going to cooperate further. No, he always wanted to come forward and explain things, and he likes this role, actually. It's a bit like a teacher coming and explain to everyone what happened. But the fact that he continued really impressed me. I would have easily envisaged, would have said, no, I'm not coming anymore. But he did.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So looking forward a bit, what do you think the major impacts of the ECCC will be for Cambodia, both now and, say, 20 years in the future?
I think the ECCC, when everything would be over, we don't know yet, because we're at the crossroad now. We don't know if further cases will move forward. But what people will remember is that it was the case that put an end to the impunity of the Khmer Rouge crimes. Even though some died, Pol Pot was not there anymore, Yang Sari died during the proceedings. Still, we had the number two of the regime, Nguyen Xia, who said himself that every decision in this regime was taken by Pol Pot and himself, and maybe others as well, but at least those two. So at the number two, it's not nothing. Khieu Samphan also, Duch major most responsible person because of the infamous S21 center. So I think those represent really a new time for Cambodia, showing that whatever you do, the crimes you committed, even long time after, you can be tried. So you have to think twice about what you do. And that's the message sent to every leader in the world, also with the ICC. But here in Cambodia, I think the what will also be remembered is the importance of the participation of the victims, as I said, and the civil parties who were really present. And they started opening up. Some people would not have even communicated anything about the Khmer Rouge period to their grandchildren or to their children. But suddenly some came and discussed what happened to them. And through their stories, many other people in the country recognized themselves and started to speak maybe a bit more openly. So I think the trials opened up a little bit the society to its history, the lesson learned for the future, and so on, and the communication between generations. It has been an opportunity for this to happen. And of course, with the work of DCCAM, the Ministry of the Education now with a book discussing that period, that is taught in classes. I think it became possible because the court was in the pipeline or started existing as well. It's many elements coming together that will finally help this country to learn from the past and the history, I think. That's all. Of course, it will be still a gold mine for researchers, right? Both on the legal side and on the factual side. And the fact that there'll be a center that will be dedicated to research, I mean, they will have to use not only the contemporaneous documents and many interviews collected by different organizations, but from the court as well. I think it's not the end of the analysis that is conducted. So I hope more lessons and more research, more books, and more more will be taken from this experience and help people understanding what happened and not to have it happening again elsewhere, here or elsewhere.
Yeah, we hope that interviews like this will help with the research as well. So thank you very much for helping and being a part of that. Before we wrap up, is there anything we haven't talked about that you think we should, or anything else that would be helpful?
No, I'm fine.
Okay, thank you for speaking with us. We really appreciate your time.